Hi everybody, my name is Carolyn and I'm here today from Taylor & Francis. My role is the Open Access Sales Manager for Europe, Middle East and Africa. And I'm here with my colleague Sinead Feeney as well, who is the Journal Sales Executive for this region. Mine's actually quite a new role that's been created within the sales team at TNF, which I think is kind of testament to the investment that the company are making in open access at the moment. So we've expanded our OA editorial team, created a new open access marketing team, and then there's various roles within sales as well. So my job is to go out and work with institutions and funders and other organisations to try and facilitate the transition to open access and to advocate OA publishing. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about the impact that OA is having on the key stakeholders within the publishing process. Obviously this is from the viewpoint of us as a global publisher, but hopefully it will give you some insight into the impact that we see at TNF. And then of course I'll go on to talk a bit about what we're doing as a publisher to fit in with the OA programmes. So usually I would preface an open access presentation with a definition. I don't think we really need that here today. We've already heard a couple, and I think everybody here knows what open access is. The only thing that I would just say is that I think quite often in conversations around open access, we concentrate a lot on the accessibility of research and is or is it not behind a paywall. And actually there's a very important second element to the OA conversation, which is around reuse and the licensing of that work, which is important not to be forgotten, I think. Again, I don't think we really need to go into this in detail. At Taylor & Francis, we kind of use similar definitions to that were covered in the OUP presentation. So gold open access is defined as being available immediately on publication, freely available, and that can be either in a hybrid or a full open access journal. So just a quick look then at what's going on in the world. This is from last year, 2015, and this shows the percentage share of full OA research output by the top 10 countries in the world. So there are a few caveats to this graph. It's only research that's indexed in the Web of Science. It's only full OA articles, so hybrid is missing. But I still think it gives us an interesting kind of insight into the OA landscape globally. So you can see there, obviously, that the US have the largest proportion of OA research output. China is growing significantly in terms of how much they're putting out in full OA journals. And you can see Brazil as well. It actually looks like it's on the decline. That's because this is a graph of percentage share. So that's being affected by the growth from China, I think. In terms of absolute numbers, the trend would be either maintained or growing slightly, I think. But it's just a useful kind of view, I guess. So more specifically in Europe then, there are several key drivers of open access within the region. A lot of these are coming from governments, funding bodies, arguably the Netherlands, kind of leading the way with their very strong advocacy of open access. The UK and Austria also heavily involved, certainly when it comes to agreements with publishers in order to make that transition happen. And, you know, certainly on a monthly basis, this is changing in terms of countries releasing new government guidelines or policies, from funder policies and things like that. So that can be a challenge in itself, kind of just keeping up to date with what's going on there. As has been talked about this morning, there's also a rise in the regional offset models that are being put in place with various publishers across Europe. And, you know, open science is so much a talking point within the academic community in Europe. And I think this kind of raises other issues around it, impact being just one of them. So as funders and institutions are investing so heavily in open access, how do they demonstrate that return on investment? How do they show that broader engagement and impact of the work that they've invested in? So I'd like to touch on the impact that this is having on three of the key stakeholders in this publishing process. So us as a publisher, you as librarians, and then also, of course, on our researchers or authors. I think as well what's quite important to bear in mind and just to stop and think about every now and then is that, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about the challenges around open access. Certainly, I have a lot of conversations both internally at TNF and externally with library customers about, you know, how can we make these new ways of doing things work and how can we overcome these barriers or analyse this data that we don't really know how to get hold of. But actually, there's also a lot of opportunities that are there, you know, certainly in terms of the role that the library can play in this, in what we can offer as publishers. And I think, you know, sometimes it's good to just kind of remember that when we're having these discussions. So first of all then, the impact on the librarian. So one of the big things that I hear about a lot in my role, well, in the new sales role, and previously I held a marketing position at Taylor & Francis, is the huge increase of admin that goes with this rise of OA publishing for institutions. So, you know, traditionally the library would process a single high-value subscription invoice. In an OA world, they're now having to potentially process multiple lower value APC invoices. The way the library teams are set up and structured, that is also impacted. So, you know, suddenly they need to work closely with perhaps scholarly communications teams or a research office who may even sit outside of the library's structure. Budgets, of course, are mostly a setup to support a subscription model. Libraries are having to juggle perhaps pots of funding from various funders, ensure that they can then report on this, that they've complied with those funder mandates for whatever it is that they've funded with that. So all of these kind of administration burdens, a lot of them are being borne by the library, I think, and that's something that, you know, they're really having to look to ways to kind of manage that. I know there was a study done a couple of years ago now, I think it was 2014, by a company called Research Consulting that looked at the cost to UK institutions of implementing OA within their libraries. And they concluded that it cost the library £81 for a single gold APC in terms of resources that it took them to process it. So it's not just about the budget for the APC, it's also the resources to kind of manage that process. Managing institutional repositories is also something that's been talked about quite a bit today, and whether that, you know, falls with the library or are there third-party organisations that can help with this. And also I think something that's worth thinking about is the idea of librarians needing to move their kind of knowledge set and their skill set to be able to help those researchers with their questions around the publishing process. So they're moving from a role of facilitating access to research to facilitating the publication of that research. And along with that goes, you know, comes with it a lot of questions from their library customers, which is something that they're gonna, you know, we've talked about training this morning, and that again, I think, is something that has to be borne in mind for libraries. And there's also this concept of the relationship dynamic kind of changing between the stakeholders. So again, in a traditional subscription world, I think usually libraries would be set up to have their dedicated account manager from a publisher who they would work with to agree their subscription agreement. And that would be it, really. Whereas now there's a lot more touch points across the two organisations that need to interact. So for us as publishers, knowing who to go to in the library, that's significantly changed, and now, you know, there's perhaps several people that will be involved with the open access side of things. And similarly for us, you know, the librarian, I have questions come into my inbox from librarians that perhaps only one of our production editors can answer and things like that. So, you know, the people across the business that need to work with each other is changing, I think. Similarly, the library's research relationship with their researchers is also, of course, being impacted. So this idea of them having to advocate, perhaps educate researchers around open access publishing and the processes that go with that is kind of changing that dynamic there as well. So putting workflows in place to enable that is again something that's having to be looked at in a lot of institutions. Okay, so moving on then, impacts on us as a publisher. So one of the first things I think would be thinking about author choice. So instead of the author publishing with us, they go down a set path. There's not really any other option for them. We're now having to make sure that we offer them the choice of publishing routes that they need from us. Tools and guidance again, so you know, things like advocacy materials, marketing materials around these OA agreements, workshops and webinars, to make sure that the message is really getting out there and that the information that they need is available to them as and when they're publishing, you know, when they need it. Best practice is also evolving, and again, this is something that's been touched on this morning. So again, as a publisher, we need to make sure we know what's, you know, what's going on in the industry, which organisations are kind of evolving these best practice guidelines, and make sure that we are a part of that. Certainly one of the biggest ones, I would say, for me is the regional variations. So I only work in Europe and Middle East, not globally, but even within Europe, the variation in funder mandates, institutional policies, research cultures has such a huge impact on open access and what, you know, what we need to be able to offer. There's certainly not a one-size-fits-all kind of approach, which obviously brings with it, you know, a lot of opportunities, but also challenges in terms of us being able to make sure that we've got all bases covered. And lastly, I think internal systems for us. So making sure we've got the data that's needed to support OA business decisions, both for libraries and for us as a business. Making sure workflows are in place, so automated processes for things like APC, invoice processing, license choices, all of these kind of things require a lot of time and investment into our systems to try and make it as smooth as possible. That is something that we are investing in at Taylor & Francis. I must say quite a lot of what we do at the moment is manual, which has kind of pros and cons, I guess. It means that we can be fairly flexible because it is still quite manual, but of course it also means it's not hugely scalable. So in terms of investing in those automated systems is really important for us at the moment. So lastly then, thinking about the author, the researcher, and I think someone earlier touched on the motivations that drive authors to publish open access and the impact that these have. And I think they do vary a lot, you know, whether it's coming from, you know, they have to in order to comply with funding mandates. All right. So these kind of variations in what's driving them, really, we see a lot of differences in the authors that we work with. So this is one TNF author who published an article that looked at the school starting times and the effect that that has on education and psychology for teenagers. And he was really concerned about the impact of his work. And this is something that we've worked quite closely with him on. We've used altmetric data, which is article level reporting, and we can see the how much this article has then been shared around the world and the impact that this has had on wider society. And it was actually picked up by the US Secretary of State for Education. It's been adopted by various organisations, picked up by the press. And that's something that is really important, I think, when we're thinking about open access, is not just the impact agenda for the author in terms of, you know, citations and downloads, but the wider impact on society and the effect that OA can have on this. I did have another example, but I'm going to whiz on because I've been flashed up for the time. And so that was just a couple of examples of specific authors. Thinking more widely then for perspectives of authors, this is a survey that was carried out by Taylor & Francis in 2013 and 2014, surveying around 8,000 authors on their perceptions of open access. This is all the reports for this are you're able to download from Taylor & Francis online. I think what's interesting here is we can see that 81% of our authors in 2014 felt that publishing their work open access would lead to wider circulation of that work, but only 29% felt that that would then lead on to furthering their citations. I know that's something that is under debate generally, and certainly was earlier today, so that's kind of an interesting insight from our authors' views there. So this is a quick look at accessibility then, moving on from impact. This is another specific example of an article that was published online in 2008. And we can see there that in the two-year period between 2011 and 2013, it had almost 4,500 downloads down the standard subscription route of publishing. In May 2013, the author chose to retrospectively convert that to open access. And we can then see, in the two-year period following that decision, the huge spike in downloads. So again, I think we can really see like tangible evidence here of how OA can increase accessibility. So what are Taylor and Francis doing about this then? So our philosophy on open access is very much about choice. We try to offer our authors the choice to publish their work in the best outlet that's most suitable for them. So we have a choice of green or gold OA options. We've got various license types, a suite of Creative Commons licenses that they can publish in, and also a whole host of journals that they can choose, both full and hybrid. You can see there we've got about 90 titles in our Taylor and Francis open portfolio, so these are our full open journals. And then we've got over 2,000 in our Open Select, which is the hybrid option. We also have Cogent, who some of you may not be quite as familiar with. It's a fairly new publisher, which sits within the Taylor and Francis group. And these are a full open access publisher who publish a series of multidisciplinary mega journals. And as a newer publisher, they're kind of able to experiment with different concepts. So they're running a pilot at the moment with Freedom APCs, where the author chooses how much to pledge, how much they want to pledge for publishing their work, how much they think that that's worth. And that data is going to be really valuable for us to be able to see the outcomes of that, I think. So in terms of business models, we've got various agreements at consortium and national level. So these are so-called offset models. We've got agreements with GIST Collections in the UK, with regional consortium in Germany, in Austria, and more recently as well in the Netherlands, which is kind of it's very recently agreed, kind of a flip model where they're going to pay to publish and then they get access rights as a part of that agreement. On an institutional level, we offer prepayments where institutions can deposit funds into a prepayment with us. And this really is to try and reduce that admin that I was talking about earlier. So they pay for this on a single invoice, and then we manage those deductions of the individual APCs. And that's worked really nicely for a lot of institutions. We're also piloting various, what we're calling all-inclusive models. So this would be like a one-off payment, and then the institution's research can all be made open access as a part of that agreement. As I mentioned earlier, with that example of a specific article, we can retrospectively convert research to become open access. And this, I think that's kind of under debate as well as to the value of that, because obviously the idea of Gold OA is that it's available immediately on publication, which retrospective isn't. So again, that's kind of different, libraries have different viewpoints on that, I think. We also have some agreements with more emerging market models. So for example, with Eiffel, which are put in place to try and remove those barriers for researchers based in those regions who may not be able to publish open access otherwise. And finally, I think we're trying to take a really flexible evidence-based approach to open access here. So we really need to hear from you what it is that you think would work or what you need from us. And certainly we're open to having those conversations and letting them kind of shape what we offer. So the offset agreements that we have in place then, they work in various ways depending on the nature of the agreement. For example, the one in the UK and the one we've got in Germany is a series of significantly discounted APCs, the number of which is based on the subscription spend. That model is kind of flipped with our agreement that we have in Austria, where we take the value of the APC spend from the previous year, and then that's credited against their subscriptions. I think there's kind of pros and cons to both of these models, and we've certainly seen quite different results, actually. So with the discounted APC model, for example, some of the institutions in Germany have seen a huge increase in the number of OA articles that their institution is outputting, and a significant decrease in the average price of their APC, which is a good story for moving towards OA. Conversely, in Austria, what we've seen is not necessarily a big increase in the number of OA articles that have been output, but a decrease in the subscription spend. So I think it kind of depends how each organisation wants to make that move towards OA and what works best for each. But as we're running these pilots, we're starting to get an idea of how they do impact on the institution or the consortium. So that's just a quick overview of where the OA articles are in our portfolio. As you probably would expect, it's heavily dominated by medicine and sciences, but there isn't any area of our portfolio that is untouched. So that's nice to see that we are starting to grow OA in each of the disciplines there. And finally, because I think I'm out of time, I just wanted to touch on the idea of the advocacy work that I think is really important as well. So it's not just about putting in place the funding and the business models and the workflow, but it's the communication around it that seems to really drive these models and be the difference between whether or not they work, to be honest. So, you know, where we've had libraries that have got really proactively involved and where we've been able to partner with them and advocate this, advocate OA publishing, that's where we've seen the best results, really. So this is just some of the work that we've gone out and done around Europe. Okay, so that was kind of a whistle-stop tour, I guess. That's my email address there, so if you do want to, if you have any questions or just want to drop me an email with any thoughts or anything, then please do get in touch. And that's it. Any questions?